Today, how lucky is the lucky country? The DFA Daily to the 7th of May 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The data keeps on coming, and as usual it packs a few surprises. The ABS released their trade data to the end of March 2020 today. The net surplus jumped to $10.6 billion from $3.9 billion in February, which was revised down from $4.4 billion previously. Goods exports were up 21.6%, supported by catch-up shipments of iron ore and gold, and as China reopened after February. Market expectations had been for about $6 billion, so this was a nice surprise. And within the data, we see that exports of goods and services jumped in March by 15%, or $5.6 billion, which was more than reversed the 6.9% drop in February. Metal ore exports were a big move, up 32%, a rise of $2.8 billion. And key to this was the rebound in iron ore production and export shipments post-Cyclone Damien. The lift in the iron ore price in Aussie dollar terms was also a plus. So too was the volatile gold export segment, bouncing off a weak base up 225%, or $2.5 billion. But service exports fell further down 9.4%, or $0.7 billion, following an 8.5% fall in February. Imports of goods and services fell in the month, down by 3.6%, or $1.2 billion, following a 4.6% fall last month. And within that, service imports collapsed down 18.6%, or $1.5 billion, following a 5.9% drop in February, reflecting the stalling of tourism and education, thanks to reduced international travel. Now, this might just mean that we do not record a GDP drop this quarter, which will then put all the damage in the June quarter, which is going to be a shocker, and we may avoid a technical recession, but we will see. And AMP's Shane Oliver is turning a bit bullish, it seems. He wrote back in January, when the bushfires were raging, "I feared Australia's luck had run out. But right now, I thank God I live in the lucky country. We are still out of the woods on virus, and there are some bad stats ahead on the economy." This is indicated by our Australian Economic Activity Tracker, which is based on high-frequency alternative data and is running down 40% on year-ago levels, reflecting a preponderance of components most affected by the shutdown. The good news is that it is up from its early April low, but there is still bad news ahead for us. In the official statistics, unemployment most likely spiked to around 10% last month, which is the highest since the 20% seen during the Great Depression, and official data is to be released in the months ahead, which will likely reflect a 10 to 15% contraction in the economy in the first half of the year, all of which risks further depressing confidence. But three things, he says, suggest Australia looks likely to come through this period of global misery relatively well compared to many other countries, and this may mean that the Australian economy contracts less and rebounds faster, ultimately supporting Australian asset classes relative to other countries' assets. First, he says, Australia has performed better than many countries in controlling the outbreak. While things were bleak in late March, Australia's success in controlling the outbreak stands out globally. After a rapid escalation in new cases, Australia imposed a shutdown around the 22nd of March. New cases peaked in late March at over 500 a day and have since declined to less than 30 a day, albeit with a few clusters still causing problems. New cases may have peaked in the US, but are still averaging around 29,000 per day. Comparing OECD countries in how they manage the outbreak based on recovery rates, active cases per capita, total cases per capita, adjusted for the number of days since the first case, and testing per capita, Australia ranks first, with New Zealand second, guess where your next overseas holiday might be, compared to Italy at 28th, the UK at 31st, Sweden at 36th, and the US, the worst performer in the OECD, at 37th. Better weather, less congested living, a younger population, and luck may have all played a role, but the big driver looks to have been a public health response driven by expert medical advice as opposed to bravado or crackpot theories. And this has been backed up by Australians pulling together to do the right thing. By contrast, Europe and the US have been marked by a slower response. For example, lockdowns in Italy and Spain did not occur until new cases per million people were around 30, compared to around 12 in Australia. And Australia has achieved a similar virus outcome with a less stringent lockdown than the one in New Zealand. Australia's better record in containing the virus means two things, he says. First, it has kept pressure off the health system, so those who need hospitalisation can get it. As a result, Australia has managed to do a much better job of saving its own people than many other countries. Deaths per million people are around 3.9 in Australia, compared to 84 in Germany, 221 in the US, 280 in Sweden, 443 in the UK, and 495 in Italy. That's 124 times worse than Australia's death rate. The value of saved lives swamps the costs to the economy from the shutdown. And it also provides Australia more scope to open the economy sooner and with a greater confidence that a second wave of cases will be avoided, in contrast to the US, where there is no clear downtrend in new cases. Indications from the government are that a phased easing of the shutdown looks on track to start this month, with most businesses running again by July. The global government policy response to the economic threat posed by the virus shutdowns has been huge. However, in many countries, it includes a large element of loans and debt guarantees as opposed to actual fiscal stimulus in the form of spending or tax cuts. For example, providing a loan or a guarantee to enable a loan to a business to help it to survive the shutdown versus providing it with a wage subsidy. Loans and guarantees are helpful, but they leave businesses more indebted, whereas actual fiscal stimulus provides a direct boost. So actual fiscal support is a better measure. And on this front, Australia at 10.6% of GDP has provided by far the strongest fiscal stimulus of G20 countries. What's more, Australia's centrepiece JobKeeper wage subsidy is superior to approaches taken by many other countries, as it keeps people employed, minimises confidence-zapping negative headlines around unemployment, preserves the employer-employee relationship, keeps workers getting paid, and provides a subsidy to struggling businesses. Unemployment is likely to rise to around 10%, which is bad, but it is far better than the 15% that would likely occur in the absence of JobKeeper, or 20% or so unemployment, as in the US. Third, Australia's major trading partner is 2 to 3 months ahead of the rest of the world. And so we can benefit from our biggest export market, China, which takes a third of our exports, being ahead of the global recovery curve by around 2 to 3 months and focusing there on infrastructure spending. This explains why prices on our key export, iron ore, are holding up relatively well compared to, say, the price of oil, of which we are a net importer. If, as appears likely, a phased easing of the lockdown starts this month, then April should prove to be the low point in economic activity, and growth should return to the economy in the second half. This does not mean that things will quickly bounce back to normal. The easing of the lockdown will likely be gradual to minimise the risk of a second wave. Some businesses will not reopen. Uncertainty will linger, and debt levels will be higher, and business models will have to adapt to different ways of doing things. This may mean returning to the office on a rotational basis, and shops and restaurants reopening, but with distancing rules. Domestic travel may be back within a few months, but international travel looks unlikely in the absence of a vaccine until next year, maybe except to New Zealand. But it will still see a return to growth, albeit, he says, it may not be until the end of next year that we see economic growth returning to pre-virus levels. The combination of better success in controlling the virus with less risk of a second wave, better protection of the economy with a stronger policy response, and Australia's exposure to China makes it likely that the Australian economy will contract less and recover faster than other comparable countries. While many fret that without tourism and immigration, Australia can't recover, this is not true. The travel ban has only accounted for a small part of the hit on the economy. Australia actually has a tourism trade deficit of 1% of GDP, and we actually lose more from Australians going overseas than we gain from foreigners coming here. So a ban on international travel will actually boost GDP. However, we do have a 2% trade surplus in education, and this would be lost if foreign students can't come. Similarly, immigration contributes less than 1% to economic growth each year in Australia. However, this is all dwarfed by the 10 to 15% hit to economic activity, which has mostly come from the domestic shutdown. And it could be argued that a workable testing and quarantine requirement could be introduced to allow students and immigrants to return in, say, 6 to 9 months' time. The main risks to watch for are a second wave of the virus cases driving a new shutdown beyond the six-month protection out to September provided by JobKeeper, increased job seeker, and the bank debt payment holidays. The lockdown triggering a house price crash, resulting in severe second-round effects on the Australian economy. This is probably a much greater risk if the lockdown continues beyond September, and political tensions around the origins of COVID-19 damaging Australia's trade relationships with China in some way. If, he says, as we expect the combination of better success in controlling the virus, a stronger economic policy response and exposure to a recovering Chinese economy results in a relatively stronger recovery for the Australian economy, then Australian assets should benefit relative to global assets. And this could come via an appreciation of the Aussie dollar, which is, in fact, what has been happening more recently. And taking a longer view, new Ahuri research reveals that current seemingly high rates of home ownership in Australia are masking a long-term problem of serious housing inequality between older and younger generations and between wealthier and poorer households. This is not unique to Australia, as the research also compares Australia's ownership performance with 14 other Western countries and finds home ownership is in retreat generally. The research, Australian Home Ownership Past Reflections, Future Directions, undertaken for Ahuri by researchers from Swindon University of Technology, examines the growth of home ownership and its tenure dominance in Australia after the Second World War, together with its fading, most notably for younger households aged 25 to 44 over the last 4 decades. While Australia's overall home ownership rate appears to have held up well, it was 68% in 1976, 67% in 2016. The rate is projected to decline to around 63% for all households by 2040 and to 51% of households in the 25 to 55 age bracket, down from 60% in 1981. A housing system in which one half predominantly older homeowners acquires wealth and the other half generally younger renters doesn't is a recipe for long-term social problems, says lead researcher Professor Terry Burke of the Swinburne University of Technology. The research suggests that while no single policy failure, single political decision, or single market or state failure has eroded the ability to achieve the ownership dream, the change has come from complex shifts throughout the entire institutional environment. While weakening affordability has been an important factor in this erosion, other factors should not be neglected, including an increase in casualised employment, a financial and tax environment favouring rental investors, the emergence of new housing products largely designed for rental living, the inability of housing supply to match population and household growth, and the financialization of housing. The financialization of housing is an international factor and is best understood as the process where housing is treated as a commodity to be invested in rather than as a home, meaning more and more money flows into housing, but without any necessary improvement in housing supply or quality, says Professor Burke. An important finding in the context of COVID-19 is that crises such as the global financial crisis, which produced major falls in dwelling prices in many countries, although less so in Australia, did not create a return to ownership. Fiscal austerity, lack of finance, weakened household income, purchases being outbid by investors for available finance all meant ownership in most Western countries fell sharply after the global financial crisis, rather than increased. Broadly, Australia now has an institutional environment which no longer supports ownership as it did in the past, says Professor Burke. This means the housing system will become more inequitable, irrespective of what incremental housing policy reforms are made. Given this, we have to rethink what sort of housing system is appropriate for Australia's future. Either we embrace fundamental and broad-based reforms to rebuild ownership, or we accept a retreat from its historical dominance, moving to a system which has more balance between rental and ownership, what we can call a dual tenure system. For government's new policy instruments will be needed to give renters the opportunity to achieve greater security, affordability, and livability in private rental, while also rebuilding social housing. But policies beyond housing are also important, including enabling renters to create wealth and/or processes to redistribute some of the asset-generated wealth of owners. In addition, governments will need to supply greater income support for households in older age, as older renters on the age pension struggle with unaffordable rents. And none of these will be achieved unless Australia has a national housing and urban strategy to facilitate a policy conversation around a housing future. And I have to say that I think that is a good commentary on where we are and what needs to be done. But my worry is that the knee-jerk reaction to coming out of the COVID crisis is to throw money at short-term strategies, for example, giving away further incentives to try and get more first-time buyers into the market, to change from stamp duty through to some sort of land tax, and to fast-track development opportunities of high-rise construction on the outskirts of town, as we're seeing already being discussed in New South Wales. Plus, of course, the ironic situation where houses can be opened for visitors to buy them, but houses of worship are still closed. But the concern I have is that if we don't take this opportunity to craft a strategic alternative, then we're going to just repeat the mistakes of the past. And the tactical need to try and stoke growth quickly may actually overtake the strategic opportunity that we have to lay the foundations for a future where housing is predominantly seen not as an investment class, but as somewhere to live. That actually is probably the challenge that needs to be answered if Australia is truly long-term to remain the lucky country. The risk that I see as we take the shortcut route and try and repeat the mistakes of the past. And from a political perspective, you can understand why they might want to do it. But from a strategic perspective, that would be one of the biggest mistakes of all. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.